remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles, we're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried after the revolution. Prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air, and Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks. Organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm. Political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Coming up next, the whale that spoke human. Whales are famous for their intelligence, and a new paper from neurobiologist Sam Ridgway argues that at least one beluga whale could imitate human speech patterns. Emmett Fitzgerald reports on Nock, the whale with remarkable vocal power.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwin. Beluga whales are known as canaries of the sea because of their musical voices and talkative nature. Legend has it that sailors believe the songs of belugas were the voices of drowned men speaking from beneath the waves. Well, new research suggests that belugas may be able to sound human, giving some basis to those old maritime myths. Living on Earth's Emmett Fitzgerald updates the yarn.
If there's anybody out there who speaks whale, it's Dr. Sam Ridgway. He's been studying the behavior of marine mammals for a very long time.
I recently figured it out. It had been 52 years and 8 months. I work with mainly bottlenose dolphins, California sea lions, and white whales. I call them white whales. I like the name better than beluga whales.
Dr. Ridgway is a neurobiologist and the president of the National Marine Mammal Foundation, and he's just published a paper in the journal Current Biology. The paper argues that belugas are capable of imitating the speech patterns of humans. This research began way back in 1984. Dr. Ridgway was working with a group of three belugas from the Arctic when something very strange occurred.
One day, we started hearing voices like a distant conversation on another pier here in San Diego Bay. We didn't think much of it because we thought it was human conversation. Then a diver who was using underwater communications equipment got out of the water and said, "Who told me to get out?" And he was next to this whale's pen, and the dive supervisor had not said anything or told him to get out. And the only alternative was the whale.
The researchers determined that the human-like noises were coming from a whale they called Noceum, Nosy for short, after the swarms of maddening insects that thrive in the Arctic. Once he was moved to San Diego, Nosy spent a lot of time with divers, trainers, and veterinarians. At some point, it seems that the white whale began to mimic the sounds he heard coming from his human caretakers. These new noises were several octaves lower than his normal register, so Nosy needed to develop a special method to create them. He learned how to overinflate two air sacs above his nasal cavity, a behavior never before seen in beluga whales. Dr. Ridgway compares Nosy's new voice to another famous musician.
One example I've given is a human trumpeter. Normal trumpeters play music and they do it very well, but Louis Armstrong could make the trumpet talk and make pops and do all sorts of unique things. So this is a whale that taught his vocal system to do something a bit different.
We've got a recording of Nosy speaking human. Here it is. Dr. Ridgway doesn't argue that Nosy is saying real words, but these noises are very different from normal beluga songs. It wasn't only the unusual sounds that Nosy made. Dr. Ridgway did a visual analysis of patterns in the whale's speech. When viewed through a device called a spectrogram, Nosy's voice patterns looked remarkably human. Though we may never have a conversation with a whale, Dr. Ridgway believes that we can already communicate in basic ways.
We train them to make a certain sound, and they tell us when they hear another sound. So we can communicate on that level. Who knows what extent we can learn to communicate with these animals. We hope that others will take this up and do more rigorous work.
Scientists still have a lot to learn about whale communication. Although Nosy died 5 years ago, Dr. Ridgway hopes that the strange noises he created will inspire further research into these curious ocean creatures. For Living on Earth, this is Emmett Fitzgerald.
Can't you sense the mist? us blue. There's something coming out from you. It may not be the whole view. I bet your advisors would deny. Cause that's what they are made to do. To follow like a maiden cry. Whenever dirt gets in your eye. Shouldn't I conform now that you're the norm? I'm not sure this quite holds true. Why am I distressed? Can't you sense this mess? We're not red or white, just blue.
Coming up next, insuring for climate change. Scientists expect more severe storms like Sandy as a result of climate change, and insurance companies are paying attention. Steve Desart, former communication manager for reinsurer Swiss Re, tells host Steve Kerwood that rates will rise and some properties will be uninsurable as climate change brings about more fierce weather.
It'll be months before the costs of Superstorm Sandy are tallied, but estimates currently range to $50 or $60 billion or even more. Insurance companies will pick up the tab for part of that, and they're paying attention when scientists say climate change will increase the severity of storms. Steve Dishart used to manage communications for Zurich-based Swiss Re, a company that's part of the large reinsurance industry. Insurance companies manage their risks by buying policies against catastrophic loss from reinsurers. We reached Dishart at his home in Westchester County, just north of New York City, where after the storm, he's got no electricity or heat.
Well, I'm missing heat, but fortunately I've got a wood-burning stove, so I'm sitting in front of a wood burner talking to you on my cell phone. This is the second time in exactly 12 months I've had to do the same thing. You know, we had the storm last year with the heavy snow that brought the trees down and brought the power down, and now a year later we're dealing with it again.
Now, Steve, it's too early, of course, to really know, but how big a deal is this Superstorm Sandy?
The two largest losses in terms of weather have been Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Katrina. I think this is going to be somewhere in between. It's hard to tell right now what the loss will be, but you have to think about all the losses related to flooding, in particular with homes all up and down the East Coast. There's also business loss interruption, which, of course, will be significant because we have one of the largest commercial regions in the country. So we're talking very large impact and one of the most significant in our country's history. But in the long run, I think the more important impact is on our thought process with regard to climate change.
What's the consensus in the insurance industry about climate change?
I don't want to speak for the entire industry, but I think there is a view within the reinsurance industry that climate change will continue to have an impact and continue to increase. And it's not just about global warming. The issue is volatility and severity with regards to the climate. And that is what's changing, and that's what we need to prepare for.
Volatility, you mean that things just change rapidly?
I mean that we have more events more often. They're more severe. The floods are increased, and the droughts are increased as well. This is a matter of climate change. It is happening, and it is a reality. The fact that some people don't want to buy into human contribution to climate change, to me, is unfortunate but irrelevant. Climate is changing. There is tremendous agreement among scientists that it is changing, and we're beyond the point now where we can adjust and try to dampen the impact. In fact, sadly, we need to face the concept of adaptation.
Does this increase in the frequency and severity of these storms affect the ability of your industry to write policies?
It certainly affects the pricing of policies. When you look at a situation and people want to get insurance, you have to say, well, what does that cost? You know, should we be subsidizing through the government or through other means people who desire to live out on an island or out somewhere that's more vulnerable? Or should they be paying a higher rate or not be insured and be able to self-insure?
So Munich Re recently put out a report just 2 weeks before this storm that was entitled Severe Weather in North America, writing, and let me quote them here, "Nowhere in the world is the rising number of natural catastrophes more evident than in North America. The study shows a nearly quintupled number of weather-related loss events in North America for the past three decades compared to an increase factor of 4 in Asia and 2 in Europe. Why do you think we're seeing more climate-related natural catastrophes in North America than other parts of the world?"
Well, keep in mind, particularly when it comes to hurricane, that one of the generators of hurricane is warm water. And we look at the Gulf of Mexico, we look at the hurricane generator, the warm water there. We also have extreme penetration of insurance in North America, which also increases the loss rates. If you took a map of North America and you looked at migration over the last 30 to 40 years, and then you took a map and looked at the most severe events, it appears that North Americans like to move where disasters happen. So we have had all these events in Florida, along the Gulf, in California, and we have the most dense population that we can move into those areas. And the unfortunate thing is, Steve, that we don't see the tremendous losses when we look at third world countries because, tragically, poorest areas in Nicaragua, in Dominican Republic, in Haiti, don't have the housing, don't have the protection that we have here. So they don't have the insurance that we have in the United States and other parts of North America.
Yeah, there's a saying that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. What do you think the crisis that's been brought on by Superstorm Sandy, what's the benefit that could come out of this?
Well, the benefit is that I've heard Mayor Bloomberg in New York City, I've heard Governor Cuomo talk about climate change in an atmosphere where people are listening. Perhaps there is a learning moment for us here to realize that climate change is happening, that we cannot protect everybody from every potential risk, and that we need to prepare for what may happen in the future.
Steve Deshart is a former managing director of communications for Zurich-based Swiss Re and now teaches at Baruch College in New York. Thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure, Steve. Good to be with you.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, from the movie Clueless, Cher debates whether all oppressed people should be allowed refuge in America.
Should all oppressed people be allowed refuge in America? Amber will take the con position. Cher will be pro. Cher, 2 minutes.
So, okay, like right now, for example, the Haitians need to come to America. But some people are all, what about the strain on our resources? But it's like when I had this garden party for my father's birthday, right? I said RSVP because it was a sit-down dinner. But people came that, like, did not RSVP. So I was, like, totally bugging. I had to haul ass to the kitchen, redistribute the food, squish in extra place settings. But by the end of the day, it was like, the more, the merrier. And so, if the government could just get to the kitchen, rearrange some things, we could certainly party with the Haitians. And in conclusion, may I please remind you that it does not say RSVP on the Statue of Liberty. Thank you very much.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I bet there's rich folks eating from a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. If they freed me from this prison, if that railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line. Far from Folsom Prison, that's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
That's all, folks.